Last week, Jim spoke from 1 Samuel chapter 8, and this week we want to pick up where he left off. And where he left off, actually, interestingly enough, was not with 1 Samuel chapter 8, and was not with Samuel, and was not with the people of Israel demanding the king, and was not with the people of Israel who wanted to be like all the other nations. Where he left off was with us, with the church. Right, and the question that, or the challenge that he left us with was, you know, how is it that we want to be like all the other people out there, right? How is it that we as a church end up being tempted to want to just be like everybody else, to have leaders like everybody else, to have programs like everybody else, to be successful like everybody else? And so we'll pick up with that, and we'll take the story forward with us, and we'll ask, okay, if we were to imagine how this plays out over the next few months, you know, we're in the midst of a transition as a church. How is this going to play out, this sort of desire that we might have as a church to be like everybody else? And so let's fast forward. Let's go to February. I know it's February. It's been a hard winter. There's a hard winter coming, right? Okay, it's been a hard winter, especially for people who just don't like winter. And so it's February. And there's been lots of other hard things that have happened in the meantime. Let's imagine them, right? The roof here has started to leak, right? As it does often, right? Marvin knows this, right? So there's roof problems, and so the building is starting to fall apart. And the finances, you know, have been a little bit tenuous. They just get worse and worse and worse. So by February, things are really bad with the building, with the finances. The search committee has been meeting, and they have not been able to make any progress at all, right? They can't find anybody who is possibly interested in this building and this church and this congregation, right? So they get to February and they are really discouraged, and the whole congregation is really discouraged. So what do? We have a potluck, okay? So we have a potluck one Sunday, right? In the midst of our discouragement. And we're, you know, all set up on tables, in tables here, and, you know, we're kind of having a good time, and then a stranger walks in. And a stranger is really very striking. First of all, he's tall, right? He's a foot taller than I am, right? He's tall, and he is really good looking. He has like John Wayne good looks, you know, the chiseled face. He's that kind of guy. And he comes in, and nobody much notices him, but I notice him. And by the way, as this story progresses, you'll notice I'm playing the part of the leader who's on his way out, okay? So I'm the leader on his way out, and I know there's a leader coming in, and I look at this guy, and you know what I say? I say to myself, this is the one, right? This is the one, right? And so I go up to him, and I start talking to him, and he says, have you seen my donkeys? And I, you know, I say, well, you know, no, I haven't seen any donkeys. He said, you know, my dad, he had this big donkey farm in Belchertown, and the donkeys escaped, and they're running somewhere over the countryside. I've been looking everywhere for them, and my sidekick here said, well, there's a church there. Maybe they know where your donkeys are. I say to him, you know what? Forget about the donkeys. You shouldn't be worrying about donkeys, because you are the one. You are what we have been waiting for. You are the longing of Stony Brook. Right? So I say this to him, of course, quietly, because there's a search committee I don't want to bypass. So I say this to him, and then I say, I whisper to Betty Kuipers, the keeper of the kitchen, I say, I put aside some special food in there, right? This guy doesn't get regular potluck food. He gets the special, really good food that I set aside. Could you bring that out and set it in front of him? So that we bring it out and we set it in front of him, and he eats this big meal. And then, the end, you know, everybody leaves, but in the parking lot, you know, when everybody is left, I pull out my secret bottle of oil that I keep with me, and I pour it on his head, and I say, you are the one. And I say, okay, here are my instructions to you. When you leave here, this is what's going to happen. You are going to go down, you'll pass a cemetery just at the bottom of the hill, you can't miss it, right? At the cemetery, someone's going to walk out and meet you and say, the donkeys have been found, now your dad is really worrying about you, so go back to your dad. So you'll, you know, that'll be the first sign. Then you'll get to Five Corners, and Five Corners, you'll meet three men. One of them will be carrying three goats, one of them will be carrying 2 dozen donuts, and the other will be carrying this big box of coffee, right? They will give you 2 dozen donuts, and then you are to go on your way. Then you'll actually go home, you'll get to Belchertown, and on the Belchertown Green, there will be this Pentecostal revival going on. And this Pentecostal revival, you're going to go up to it and join it, and all of a sudden, you're going to be overcome by the Spirit. You'll start speaking in tongues and prophesying and falling down slain in the Spirit, and then you'll be a changed person, and you'll know what to do. Okay, so, you know, the guy, whose name, by the way, is Shaul, goes out, and he leaves. All of this happens. He gets to Belchertown, and, you know, he falls down in this Pentecostal revival, and people who have known him for years in Belchertown say, when they see him, they say, is Shaul also among the Pentecostals? Right? They're really surprised at this, right? But, you know, this happens, and then, you know, he goes back home, and nothing happens after that. And Stony Brook is just left where it was, you know, sort of continuing to muddle on until a couple weeks later. A couple weeks later, we have this congregational meeting, right? And this congregational meeting, you know, we're sitting there trying to figure out what we're going to do. Nobody else except me knows about this Shaul guy who's been anointed already. So we're sitting there waiting for what to do, and all of a sudden Shaul shows up at the congregational meeting. And everybody is saying, what are we going to do about this pastor thing? And I say, I have a good idea. Okay, let's do this. What we're going to do is we're going to put all of our chairs in a big circle, right? We're all going to sit around in these chairs. And what we're going to do is we're going to put a bottle in the middle. And we're going to spin that bottle around. And the person that bottle points to, that's going to be the new pastor. Is this a good idea? And you say, great. Well, this is as good as an idea as we've had so far. So we sit down and we do it. And we spin the bottle around. And what do you know? The bottle points to an empty chair. And we say, well, who was sitting in that chair? There was someone in that chair a minute ago. And so we search through the building, and we find Shaul down in the boiler room, hiding, right? So we pull him out, and we pull him up here, and I say, look at this guy. He is the image of the great pastor. I mean, look at him. Look at how tall he is. Look at how good-looking he is. Look at, you know, you're going to make him your pastor, right? And so you all say, well, that sounds like a good idea, except some of you kind of murmur under your breath, you know, what kind of a way is this to pick a pastor? But most of you say, this is really good. Dan likes him, so, you know, he must be the new pastor. And so, you know, he's going to be the new pastor, but then he goes back to Belchertown again, right? And doesn't show up for a couple of weeks. A couple of weeks later, things have gotten really, really bad, okay? The financial situation is a mess. The building is actually starting to completely fall apart. It's being condemned. The town is coming here, and they're going to kick us out and close us down as a church. And so we're really in trouble, so we send this delegation. We send this delegation to Belchertown, and they're weeping as they go. And they go weeping to Belchertown, and they find Shaul, and Shaul is out actually with his chickens in the yard, right? He's got donkeys and chickens, I guess. So he's with his chickens in the yard. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to hold this together here. Okay, so Shaul is with his chickens, and we tell him this sad story about Stony Brook and how bad it is. And Shaul is really upset. And you know what he does? He tears apart a chicken. He tears it into pieces, and he... And this is all in the Bible, okay? It is. Not the chicken, but almost, okay? So he tears apart this chicken, and he sends out pieces to every family in Stony Brook with this message. If you do not increase your giving to Stony Brook and increase your commitment to Stony Brook, this is what I'm going to do to your chickens. I'm going to tear them apart. And everybody trembles, especially the Hartleys and the Goulds. Right? Okay, so, and then he comes and things turn around. It's amazing how quickly things turn around in the church. Right? Giving goes up. Everybody really loves this church from now on. They're really committed to it. And Shaul is unanimously brought in as pastor. And he begins this wonderful period of leadership, and everybody loves him, and the people who didn't like him before, the other people say, well, they should be kicked out or killed, right? And Shaul says, no, this is a good time for Stony Brook, we should be benevolent to them. And so everything starts out really well, and Shaul starts this new pastorate. This is a really, really good story, right? Okay, last part of the story. Very last part of the story, we fast forward to May. I'm leaving, right? I give my farewell address to you. And I say, you know, you have been an evil, evil bunch. I want to put this challenge to you. I want to say, first of all, I want to ask you, have I ever done anything to hurt any of you? Have I cheated you? Have I taken any of your chickens? Have I torn any of your chickens apart? No, I have not done any of those kinds of things. I say this to you, and I say, you know, what have I done to offend you in any way? You say, no, nothing, you've been great. But I say, and then I say, but you had these evil, evil desires for a new pastor, for a new kind of leader, and now you've got him, right? And this is a terrible thing. This is a terrible thing that you wanted, and all of you feel really bad, and you want to repent, and I say, oh, but that's okay, but if you and your new pastor do not clean up your ways and be really faithful from now on, then God is just going to wipe you all away. That is how 1 Samuel chapter 12 ends. And basically, in this story, we have covered 1 Samuel chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, and chapter 12 with some minor variations, okay? We made a few little changes just to, you know, make it a little bit relevant to our situation, but that is the story. And so we come to the end of 1 Samuel chapter 12, and two questions should immediately arise. What kind of a way is this to pick a leader? First of all, who would pick a leader in this way? You know, the guy, Saul, is out looking for his donkeys. He's a farm boy. He's lost. He knows nothing about leadership. He doesn't even know who Samuel is, right? And Samuel is this big figure in Israel, and he doesn't know who Samuel is. He is lost. He has to get his servant to tell him to go and find the holy man to get directions from. He doesn't know what he's doing, and he ends up anointed as king of Israel. How does this happen, right? How is this going to happen? And so the first question is, you know, how do leaders get picked? I mean, oh, this is a crazy way to pick a leader. And then the second question is, you know, how is this going to turn out well? You know, how on earth is this going to turn out in any sort of a positive way, right? And we know it isn't. We know that the way that things start here is a really bad sign for where things are going to go. We have all of the premonitions. I mean, Saul from the beginning has a deer in the headlights kind of look on his face in every critical encounter. He just is clueless. He really is clueless right from the beginning. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't do some great things. He does, you know. He can kill his Philistines, right? And he does, and his Amalekites, and he will. But Saul, as we take the story forward, actually becomes this really tragic failure. Really tragic failure. When he's faced with really critical decisions, he often dithers, right? He's often sitting under the tree when his son Jonathan is the one who says, actually, action is needed now, and goes out and does it. And Saul is back there sitting under the tree. Or when David comes along and says, well, I'll go and face that giant, where is Saul, right? Saul is sitting back there waiting for somebody else to do it. So he dithers, or sometimes he doesn't dither. Sometimes a decision is required, and the decision that he takes is impetuous and turns out really badly. And several times he makes these really bad decisions. So he's either dithering or he's impetuous. As time goes on, he will descend into jealousy. He'll become mentally unbalanced. It's very clear he's becoming mentally unbalanced by the time he's trying to kill David later on in the book, right? He's off his rocker, right? He's gone crazy. He's gone a little insane, and we can see that. Now, he has moments of clarity, moments where, you know, he comes back to his right mind, but through much of the book, he's back and forth, in and out of sanity. Right? And then finally, he ends up actually pretty pathetic. And the pathetic scenes are really, really quite touching, and we can read one in 1 Samuel chapter 15. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 24, this is at a point where Saul has actually come to the point where God is, and Samuel have rejected him as king. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have violated the Lord's command and your instructions. I was afraid of the people, and so I gave in to them. Now I beg you, forgive my sin and come back with me so that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to him, I will not go back with you. You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel. As Samuel turned to leave, Saul caught hold of the hem of his robe, and it tore. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Saul replied, I have sinned, but please honor me before the elders and my people in Israel. Come back with me so that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel, actually, the verse here gets the translation wrong. So Samuel went back with Saul. Actually, it's much more likely that the text here means Samuel did not go back with Saul. That from that point on, Samuel had nothing to do with Saul. So Saul is abandoned by the one person who can give him guidance in Israel, and there's this pathetic scene of him reaching out and clutching at his robe, please come back to me, or at least come and don't embarrass me completely before the elders of Israel. And it's this pathetic scene of the man who's been abandoned by God, abandoned by the prophet, and is on his own, and from this point on, he'll go completely downhill. It's really sad what happens to Saul. It is really sad what happens to Saul. Whose fault is it? Right? Whose fault is this? Is it Samuel's fault, right? I mean, Samuel's the one who anointed him, right? I mean, you would all blame it on me if a stranger came in and I anointed them pastor, right? You'd have right to blame it on me, right? He thought he heard the voice of God. Well, you know, look at how it turned out. Is it Samuel's fault? Or is it the people of Israel, right? You know, you all went along with it, right? I mean, the search committee, they all liked him too. They liked his John Wayne good looks, right? Is it their fault, right? Whose fault is it? Is it the congregation? Is it Samuel, right? Is it Saul's fault, you know? Was he the right one, but he turned bad in the end? You know, was it his fault? But you look at Saul, and he tries so hard to do it right. He is clutching out, reaching out for knowledge, for understanding of what he's supposed to do, and he doesn't. He's just clueless, the poor guy. You can't help but feel sorry for him in this story. So whose fault is it? Chapter 9, verse 17. When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, "This is the man I spoke to you about. He will govern my people." Chapter 10, verse 9. As Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. When they arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him. The Spirit of God came upon him with power, and he joined in their prophesying. Whose fault is it? It's God. God is the one who chooses Samuel. God very clearly chooses Samuel. We get it reinforced over and over again. It is God who chooses this leader who will be a failure. This leader who will be a tragic failure, who will cause all sorts of pain to himself, all sorts of pain to Israel. It is God who chooses him. And that actually ends up being a pretty frightening thought, right, for us? It becomes a pretty frightening thought. It's God who's choosing a failed leader, God who's choosing a bad leader, right? And we think, why would God choose flawed leaders? Why would God choose a Saul, right? And we think, why wouldn't he just bypass Saul and go to the one he ended up really wanting, right? David. David's a good leader, right? So look forward to David, right? Let's imagine we skip Saul. What's going to happen with David? David will have his good moments, no question about it. Yeah, and then remember what he'll do with that friend and army commander of his, Uriah the Hittite, send him out, get him murdered so that he can have his wife, right? That's what David will do. And then at the end of his life, what will happen? Because it turns out to actually be a weak leader, his family will fall apart into civil war, and the end of his reign will be a disgrace, actually. So what kind of leader is David going to be? Chosen by God? Flawed, right? So all we have here is these flawed and sinful leaders. Why does God choose them? Why does God choose flawed and sinful and weak and impetuous leaders? Well, I mean, think about it. What choice does he have? I mean, who else is he going to choose, right? Where else does he get the material from, right? There is nobody else but flawed and sinful and impetuous leaders. There's nobody to choose from other than those. That's all God has to work with. And so every leader that God places his hand on and says, you're going to lead my people, whether it's in Israel or whether it's in the church, is actually going to have a dose of Saul in them. A big dose of Saul in them, probably. David had a big dose of Saul in him. And if we miss that in the story, we've missed a big part of the point, right? That every leader, and go on in the story, right, to the kings, right? The kings that follow. Well, Solomon, right? Great, great example. Wonderful king, right? Except that he has all these wives and concubines who turn him aside from the ways of the Lord, so that his rule also ends kind of in disgrace. So as we go on, and then they get worse and worse, as we go on, there are no leaders who are not deeply flawed in some way. So, you know, God has no choice but to choose leaders like this. So what's the point, right? I mean, what is God supposed to do? What are we supposed to do with this picture, except actually check my notes and see where I got lost here. One second. Sorry about that. Ah, the point of the story. Yeah, there we go. Okay, the point, this actually brings us to the most curious part of the story of Saul. As he's being called as king, the most curious part actually is a part that shows up in chapter 10 that we read part of. I'll read again. Chapter 10, verse 9, beginning in verse 9 and reading through verse 11. As Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. And when they arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him. The Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he joined in their prophesying. And when all those who had formerly known him saw him prophesying with the prophets, they asked each other, "What is this that has happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And a man who lived there answered, "And who is his father?" So it became a saying, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" Now this is interesting, okay? This is just thrown in there, right? The source of a proverb. Saul becomes the source of a proverb here. Is Saul also among the prophets? Because, you know, the people in Belchertown see him, you know, falling down, slain in the spirit, and they say, well, this is weird, you know. Is Saul also among the prophets? And a proverb is actually meant to sort of express a timeless truth, right? What are proverbs for? They're supposed to, you'll be able to say a proverb, and everybody will say, oh, you know what, yeah, that's true. I know exactly what you mean, you know, a clever way of saying it. Is Saul also among the prophets? And so we then look at this and we say, oh, this is really curious. You know, what's the point here that's being made? And you know, it just comes out of nowhere that this proverb goes back to Saul. Well, then we look forward and we see at the end of, towards the end of Saul's career as king, when, you know, he's been rejected by God, in chapter 19, we get a repetition. Chapter 19, verse 23. And here's actually the story as it unfolds. Saul by this time is after David. He's trying to kill him or capture him. And so he sends some men after David. And these men actually come upon some prophets. And these prophets are prophesying. The men he sends end up being overcome by the Spirit and start prophesying with the prophets. So they can't do anything. You know, they're in ecstasy. So he sends another group of men. Same thing happens to them. And then finally, Saul himself decides, well, I better go myself. So we pick up in verse 23. So Saul went to Naoth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even upon him, and he walked along prophesying until he came to Naoth. He stripped off his robes and also prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay that way all that day and night. This is why people say, is Saul also among the prophets? So we get this proverb again. You know, is Saul also among the prophets? And we ask, what on earth is this proverb supposed to express? And then we think, well, actually, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense if it means this. If it means, you know, it is completely incongruous that Saul is prophesying. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, this is this farm boy, right? And he is out there, and he's overcome by the Spirit, and, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing. He is just overcome, and he's among the prophets. And we look at that, and we say, that is the most unlikely thing in the world, that guy is a prophet. And we suddenly realize there's a more universal application for this. That I could say about just about any leader that I could pick out, I could apply this proverb to them. I could say, for example, is Bob Gould among the elders? I mean, there are people who knew Bob Gould when he was a kid, right? Does he belong among the elders? Where is Bob today? Am I making fun of him in his absence? Not. Oh, there he is. Is Bob Gould among the elders? Or I could say about Jim Hartley, I could say, is Jim Hartley among the preachers? I mean, there are people who knew him when he was a teenager, right? And could they imagine that he would actually be up preaching to people when he was a teenager? Could you, Judy? No, no. Is Jim Hartley among the preachers? Ha! You know, is Saul among the prophets? Or we could apply it politically. We could say, is Reagan among the great presidents? I mean, look at this. Reagan was a Hollywood actor, a B actor. Come on, is Reagan among the presidents? Is Obama among the presidents? I mean, come on, right? Why would we say this? Because you look at any leader and you look at them carefully. If you really knew them, you say, this is the most unlikely thing in the world that this person is in this position. I mean, look at them. Look at who they are. Look at who they were as a kid. Look at who they were growing up. Look at who they are now if you really know them, right? They don't belong there. They are flawed. They are sinful. They are going to make terrible mistakes. They are blind to things that they should be able to see. You can say it about your congressman, you can say it about your pastor, you can say it about your senator, you can say it about any world leader you want to. This proverb applies absolutely universally. Is Saul among the prophets? Come on. Now that actually turns out to be really interesting, because what that does then is it gives us a thoroughly biblical and Christian approach to human leadership. And that approach is that human leaders are not to be trusted. Human leaders are by nature flawed. They will be sinful. They will let you down. They will be either dithering or impetuous or both. They are going to make really terrible mistakes. Do not put your trust in them. So what's the point of human leaders? Why does God appoint them then? Well, to make exactly that point. I mean, that's going to be the point of 1 Samuel is, you go through, and there is no other nation on earth that has recorded stories about its leaders that are so deeply flawed. Why? Because the point all along is these leaders are not your real leaders. These leaders are meant constantly to remind you of the perfection of God, that God is your leader, that God is the one you trust, that God is the one to turn to. And every time you see a leader fall, or a leader fail you, or a leader do something that lets you down, you're meant to turn to God and say, that's where the answer is, not in this leader. And God is doing that through the Bible, through history, through the church, constantly. So what's the lesson? Well, the lesson is made, actually, in a less proverbial form by Samuel himself in the midst of his farewell address in chapter 21. Okay, no, chapter 12. In chapter 12, in his farewell address, beginning in verse 21, Samuel says, "Do not turn away after useless idols. They can do you no good, nor can they rescue you because they are useless." Don't turn after useless idols. And what are these useless idols? For him and for us? Well, they're kings and leaders. And the point is made also in a more direct way, in the New Testament, by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Not 1 Corinthians chapter 12, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, sorry. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 4. "For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, are you not mere men? What, after all, is Apollos, and what is Paul? Only servants, through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow." No leader is anything. It is only God who makes things grow. All they are, at best, is garden workers, farm hands, people that God puts into place for a time, like Saul, and Saul had his function in God's plan, and God puts his hand on him and says, yes, you're my leader for this time, and then he puts his hand on him again, and he says, no more, you're not my leader anymore, and that is entirely up to God. And God does that with human leaders, because human leaders are nothing in themselves. Nothing in themselves. All they are is tools for God to work out his purposes for a time, for as long as he wants them there, and then he can pull them out whenever he wants. And so we, as the church, and as people who are constantly under this temptation to idolize human leaders, and to make them bigger than they are, and to trust them more than we should, and to even look out on the political scene and say, well, you know, the great hope will be so-and-so, who we really hope will enter the presidential race because he'll straighten everything out. No, he won't. He will be as flawed as any other leader. There is no great hope out there other than God alone. And that's something that we will keep on forgetting over and over again, and we need to keep on reminding ourselves over and over again. The plan and the purpose is God's. The leaders will come and go. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, give us your perspective on time, on history, on leadership, on the church, and help us in the midst of all the ups and downs and uncertainties to trust not in any person but in you alone. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.